Welcome back to Tipsy Theology, the podcast where we say crazy things and people correct us. Today we have Johnny Benz joining us today. Dr. Johnny Benz.
Yeah.
The newly added, the official. Yeah, dude, it's great. It's great to have you on here. I was saying earlier, it's been a long time since we've spoken, and I realize that now. It's like, man, why did this happen? It's crazy.
Well,
but yeah, we've known you for...
I'm sorry. I said both of us are neglecting our responsibilities to hang out, I guess.
It's true. We failed to answer the call. It's like, what's going on there? But yeah, so I've known you for quite a few years now. Mm-hmm. You married one of my good friend's sisters, several of my good friend's sisters. Mm-hmm. Not that you married multiple women, but multiple friends from the same family. But yeah, you know, it has always been that joke that Johnny has been the guy who is like a little too perfect. And we were always kind of figuring out, like, what's going on here? Why did God do this? And now you're a doctor, so you're just, like, stacking it up there. But you wrote a thesis, and you sent it out to us that you wanted to talk to. And I'm excited to talk to you about it. It's about sexual shame. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're going to be getting into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But before we hop into that, how's everything? What's going on?
Pretty well. I'm settling into a new role as a clinical professor for Adams State University here in Colorado. I'm teaching 5 classes, which is a lot.
Dang.
They threw me in the deep end. Not threw me under the bus, but definitely threw me in the deep end. So that's been good. I'm teaching courses on... I'm also, besides being a doctor, I'm also a professional counselor. So I see clients on this, part time, and I'm teaching counselors in their master's program. So I'm teaching courses on right now on integrating religion and spirituality into counseling, overcoming childhood trauma, and some other stuff like that. So yeah, it's good, but life is going pretty well.
That's some big stuff.
Well, it's some stuff.
That's so cool. That's great to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you heard this one. We had our friend on, James, who is a counselor as well. And that was one of the things that it's cool to see how more mainstream the recognition of trauma is, and like, especially inside the church. But then we kind of spoke a little bit about, there seems to be like a little bit of a danger with a lot of people heading into it and not really knowing what they're doing too.
Mm-hmm. You mean within the church?
Has that been something that we were talking about that in particular, just cause we both go to church and see that, and he's a little bit more knowledgeable than I am, obviously. But yeah, I don't know. Has that been something that you've seen? Or that see, just, I guess, in general, not really picking on the church.
Yeah, it's definitely becoming something that's more well understood, which is really great. You know, things like the ACE study, or Adverse Childhood Experiences study, and the negative impact that has on well-being, like the tendency to overweight or have asthma, like all of those things are really tightly tied to early experiences of childhood trauma. And so, you know, it's becoming more well known. And it's also, it is a really difficult to help clients process trauma. I mean, it's an involved process that takes a lot of time. I'm glad it's becoming more of a topic of conversation. I think that's really positive overall.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's good. But yeah, I think that's what's tough for me, because I don't know if it's just like the guy side of it, or it's me in particular, but it's like, I definitely when I see someone struggling, someone's like, I want to do something to help. But I know there are times when I can do way more damage than good. And it's trying to like, how do I balance those out or recognize when I'm in way over my head? It's a tough spot.
That's why I became a counselor. Really, was I was working as a youth pastor in Missouri.
Wow.
And, you know, some of the kids would come to me and talk to me and be like, well, this happened to me, or, you know, I don't have anywhere to go, you know, with this, like, burden that I'm carrying around, or, like, set of experiences. And I was like, I have no idea what, you know, what to tell them, or how to be helpful. And so I decided that if I was going to stay in ministry, like I had to find something, had to find a way of talking to people and helping people through those traumas, because I just realized like I'm totally unqualified. So, you know, like the big thing that I would say is for you as a layperson, you know, layperson or whatever, is being a listening ear, because really what trauma does is it shuts down our ability to really, you know, because how do you speak the unspeakable? And we're going to get into that some with, you know, our conversation on shame, but, you know, it's really difficult. You lose the ability to put into language what exactly happened. And so for you being a listening ear, and for people to be able to voice what their experience has been is really important. And that's how you can be helpful.
That's really good to hear. Yeah. And that's, yeah, it can be tough to listen in that case, I think. Well, you know, this is one thing I'm curious about after hearing you say a lot of that is like, why do you think there are some people that others are more willing to speak to than like their parents or people they know well? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I've always kind of been a person that people are willing and able to talk to. And I honestly, Paul, I think that boils down to like to a genuine interest or curiosity about other people, you know? If you're a counselor and you're not curious about your clients, like that's you're not going to have very many clients, or the clients you do get aren't going to stick around for very long. So, and it also, you know, I think it also has a lot to do with the relationship dynamics that occur, you know, with parents or whatever. It's like, oh, they're an authority and they're not, they, you know, maybe they're not, there's a suspicion, I think, sometimes about authority figures. So that can be part of it too.
Okay. That's fair. And it's funny. I asked that not to like be pointing fingers at people or anything, but just as out of curiosity. Cause that's one thing that I found. It sounds like you're that way as well. I tend to find myself in situations where people are telling me way more than I expected. I'm like, whoa, I don't know how I got here, what I'm doing here, but I know this you're not talking to the right person. That's fun. But hey, before we really jump into it, what are you drinking today?
Do you want to guess?
I'm going to guess it's, so I should say for anyone listening and watching, there is a time difference between us because I'm in Florida, you're in Colorado. So there's like a 2-hour time difference, and we're recording at 4:30 right now. So it's 2:30 for you. I'm at the end of a work day typically, so I can drink a little bit more. So I'm imagining it's something light.
Yes.
It's the lightest beer you could imagine.
I am a man of sophistication. You ready for this?
Right on. Stella Artois?
No, Bush Light.
Oh! I will say, Bush has some lovely gardens.
Yes, indeed.
That's awesome. I've got this. It's a little bit... I think it's a little bit invented. It might be a real thing. It's like, I'm using Jack Daniel's Tennessee Fire and apple cider to make this like apple cider cocktail. I don't know if it's actually, it might be a thing. It might be a real thing, but I've never had Florida Polk County apple cider. So I don't even know if it's any good. I'm used to the, you know, the good old Ohio cider where there's like apple trees everywhere. And I don't think I've seen a single apple tree here in Florida. So, I don't even know if they grow here, do they? Probably. They're fake. So we'll find out there.
Okay. It's synthetic.
So that's yeah, right. It's like the Beyond Burger. It's like Beyond Apples. It's just like this goop in a lab that they're making. But we'll see if this is
okay. Yeah, let me know how that is.
I don't make the rules, you know, it's Florida. So but anyway, cheers to you.
All right. Cheers.
That's actually might just be my mixology skills, but that's actually pretty delicious.
Okay. There you go.
It's not bad at all. So it's got it might be, but I'm enjoying it. It tastes more like apple cider than anything. It's kind of like this tastes like a drink my brother Thomas would like because you can't taste the alcohol at all. And that's kind of his deal. He doesn't like the taste of alcohol at all. So, and he did an episode earlier with us where we drank ciders. So if that says anything about it, there you go. But hey, let's hop right into it then.
Okay.
The old it's fine. I think this is probably my tendency to like how I cope with things to try to lighten it up a little bit. So I'm like, all right, I probably shouldn't try to make jokes. But then there's a part of me that's like, well, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing as long as it's, you know, not offensive. So I'm wrestling with that a little bit. But yeah, so we're talking about sexual shame. Oh, go for it.
I was gonna say
there's a little bit of delay, so just cut me off.
Yeah, there is. That's we'll try and work around that, but it's a tough topic. It's really challenging for people to navigate, but and even as you know, even as a therapist, it's challenging to navigate sometimes. You know, I wrote my master's thesis on sexual shame. Mm. I also wrote my dissertation on a related topic and looked at the experience of sexual shame within counselors, and explored that.
Hmm.
It turns out that there is a relationship between like higher levels of sexual shame within the counselor means that they'll avoid the topic of sex and sexuality with their clients, which is really interesting.
Really?
I mean, that makes sense. Yeah, it makes, you know, you would expect that if you were just thinking about it, but the research that I did is the first to empirically demonstrate that. So it's kind of cool.
Dang, and here we are, breaking ground. That's awesome. Wow. Yeah, you know, so it is, and I know this is kind of the nature of what we do a little bit here. I'm going to be picking on the church probably slightly more than I should. But I think that's where I guess I'm at. I could pick on a lot of people when it comes to this. But it seems like something, I should just say the topic of sex in general is something that's very badly discussed, which leads people down every different direction besides the right one, it seems. And there are a few people that I know that teach well on it, but then it's difficult because you're mostly fighting with how do I try to shape the way that people who grew up their whole life thinking about it a certain way think about it now. And then the idea of where shame and guilt comes into it is like a whole separate topic that seems like no one's really ready for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you feel like when you're going about like researching and writing this? Because you have a lot of, obviously it's an academic paper too. So like you have a lot of resources in there, which are great. But how did you go about when you're researching that and I guess studying on this? Did you find yourself thinking about it differently?
Absolutely. You know, so shame is kind of like one of those experiences. Well, it's obviously profoundly, you know, painful. Like there's that urge to kind of, you know, disappear into the floor. Right. And so I think we're all pretty well acquainted with what it feels like to, you know, be in a shame state. But like looking at the theological aspects of it was really new for me. And, as well as like the attachment stuff that I got into and the brain stuff, like all of that was really new information. And I spent, man, I basically took 3 months and that's all I did for 8 hours a day was read and write. And that's, you know, that's where that, 100 page, whatever it is, 80, 85 pages, and 22,000 words. That's where that came from. So
it's not a coffee book table, you know, or coffee table book.
Yeah. So all of that was new, you know, and I can't actually remember why I got interested in this in the first place, aside from, you know, personal experience and exactly what you were talking about earlier, which is that, you know, like how I grew up was like, you don't talk about sex. You don't, you know, there's nothing covered with it.
And
so then that leaves a kind of a gap, and there's this unstated kind of agreement that there's something bad about sexuality. Right. And so that's kind of what I grew up with. And, so I wanted to explore that, and it's something that frightened me and challenged me. And so I think that that's, you know, kind of where my interest came from.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, it is. It is amazing how, I mean, it was the same thing for me growing up. It was this, like, even talking about it in any capacity was just shameful and wrong. So it's like, even thinking about it, it's like, how dare you even think about this thing that God created? And it seems like just because everyone's afraid that it'll be taken to a sinful place. So then I feel bad because there's people I know that they got to their wedding night and suddenly, like, this thing that you haven't been able to even consider for the last, you know, however many years, you can go for it now. And it causes a lot of like fear in a lot of people just because of how they were raised.
The truth is that it's difficult as parents. I'm not a parent, but I can imagine it being difficult to, you know, communicate really very well with your kids about sex and sexuality. You know, it's awkward, can be awkward. And let's just avoid it, you know, which, you know, you don't realize what that's creating within your kids. You know, it's that's often the way things go. Just like avoid it because it's uncomfortable. And then it becomes like something else entirely for the kid. So, yeah. What were you going to ask me, Paul?
Yeah, and that's so dangerous, because then we see, like, in the public sphere, they're like, well, the parents aren't teaching their kids, so I guess we have to. And then if they don't, then it's like, well, someone's going to, and it probably is not going to be the person you want.
Correct.
Or the thing you want, even.
Yeah, it's going to be porn or the kid next to you in the locker next to you, you know?
Yeah, who has a Playboy magazine, most likely.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that creates like unrealistic expectations and ultimately, you know, like you're judging yourself, which then can create more shame too, because it's like, I'm not that. So whether that's body image or, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so I know that was a huge part in what you wrote about too. So I think it would be, I'm trying to think of how I want to approach it. So it's like, I feel like we can all agree that it's like, yeah, there's definitely shame surrounding it. I will spend a minute on there too, because what I really appreciated was, especially in the theological realm, where you brought up how it distances ourselves, where when we engage in shame, I don't know if we can say it that way, but I guess when you have shame, there's, I'm trying to remember how you said it. You said it really well, where there's a distancing that happens between us and God, and it's kind of us like hiding ourselves from him. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I really drew, in talking about shame, I really draw on, like the earliest writings we've got, which is Genesis, right? You know, so mm-hmm. to start off with, what I would want to say is there's the distinction between shame and guilt. There's obviously some overlap, like they're very similar experiences. Mm. And they look and feel a lot alike, but the difference is that shame is about who we are, right? Whereas guilt is about what we've done.
Mm.
So, you know, you can say shame is like, I am a bad mom, right? Because that's a statement about what and who I am, versus guilt would be like, oh, I didn't do that perfectly. You know, I may have messed something up.
Mm.
Right. And that's the difference. So when we get into like a theological exploration, it really helps to start with the Genesis account of the fall. And what happens there is that immediately, you know, it talks about their eyes were open and they realized that they were naked and they were ashamed. And that really stands out as, you know, fascinating, mm-hmm. because it's like, if it was guilt, then they would have felt bad about something like what they had done, eating the apple, right? Or whatever. And versus shame is like, there's something wrong with me. And so I have to, you know, immediately, the response that you see is them distancing themselves from God. They go and hide, right? And then, you know, God comes after them, finds them.
Yeah.
And then there's this distancing from between each other as well. There's like this vertical distance that takes place as well as the horizontal, as a result of like recognizing that that they're flawed. Right. So, yeah, you have to withdraw.
Wow.
Because,
yeah,
you know, you're less than in some senses. Yeah. And it's like, when I say this, like, you recognize that you're insufficient in some way, shape or form. And that distances you. And that carries through, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into that, but that carries through right into neurobiology and attachment relationships. You know, we'll get into that piece, but sticking with the theological. Yeah, it absolutely, you know, we all recognize that we're flawed, right? Like you know, deep in your soul. And if you don't, that's an even worse problem.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But we all recognize that we're flawed and we all,
and that's a whole different thing.
Yeah. So I forget what your question was, but I hopefully answered it. So yeah,
no, that's fair. I was that. Yeah, you definitely did.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Well, you know, so it was interesting. What I'm thinking of now is taking it to like a more, I guess, a more like common example of it, and I'm interested to see if this actually carries over well. So I think about, like, there's times when I do something, or I don't do something I was supposed to. It happened when my brother and I shared an apartment. Like, hey, you were supposed to do this. I'm like, yeah, well, I didn't. And he calls me out on it. And he's like, hey, why didn't you do this? I'm like, I did it. Screw you. Like, what are you talking about? And there's just that where he's kind of exposed something that I haven't done. So I guess there's maybe, I could say, guilt for something I haven't done that I was supposed to do. So I didn't act the way I was supposed to. But then I set up this barrier, this defensiveness of like, well, hey, I'm perfect. You're not. Like, you don't know me. So would you say that would be like a form of, how do I want to say it? I guess for me, it's like, it seems like there's the overlap is guilt can lead to shame. Is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because with your scenario.
Okay, I know I jumped a few barriers.
Yeah, no, you're fine. So with your, you know, your story about with your brother, it's not just that you didn't do the thing. It's that you're the kind of trash person who wouldn't do that thing. right? And that's where the shame comes in, is because it's like, he's not saying anything about you per se, but it's what's unstated that brings that sense of shame, you know?
Hmm.
And especially if you already have like some, what's the word I'm looking for? Some insecurity around, like, you know, who you are. It's really easy for somebody to, you know, to shame you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because you have more deep-seated insecurities, like you said, about whatever it may be.
Right.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. But what,
and I think that's so what you said,
Paul, is that it caused you to put up barriers between you and your brother. And that's really fascinating because, and that ties together with what Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King Jr., but Martin Luther, the old one, what he said, how he described
the hammer guy.
The hammer. Yeah. So what he said, how he described sin was, he talked about it as the human being turned inward on himself. Homo incurvatus se, I think is a Latin phrase. And so it's, what you get is this kind of like turning away and kind of hunching imagery. And that's exactly what happened between you and your brother, right? There's like this moment of shame, and it's like this turning away, or, you know, you said putting up barriers, but that's what shame, I think, ultimately is. It's like a choosing to distance yourself from other people for self-protective measure. And what's really fascinating, this is, you know, this speaks to, well, it's just fascinating to me, but that's actually what happens neurobiologically speaking. There's this cuneiform cringe.
Yeah.
That's activated during shame states, and it's exactly that, where it's like you know it's a hunching, and what you're doing is you're exposing the less vulnerable parts of yourself to the other. You know, there's desire to withdraw and hide. Yeah, that's exactly what that is, and that's exactly what shame does, and that's exactly what that's how Martin Luther described sin. It's super fascinating.
Wow. That's crazy. So are you saying there's a physical reaction to that?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's mind blowing.
Yeah.
But it's crazy how like unsurprising that kind of is too. So it's like, why wouldn't those like root things cause, you know, physical reactions? It's like we get a toothache and it's the worst pain we've ever had, and it's this tiny little piece in our, you know, in our entire body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, that's just that's really crazy. Wow. Yeah, and it's amazing to me how it manifests itself. You know, I can throw an anecdote about, you know, one situation, and it's like, it comes down to all these areas where, you know, you do see issues and you can kind of break through those.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing that's fascinating to me about, I think, about counseling and psychology, is just how everything we do is related to something. And a lot of times it seems to be related in some kind of trauma or insecurity.
Yeah, very much so.
I guess carrying that through then, how can we recognize that in ourselves? And how do we recognize that? It's probably easy to recognize in other people, but I guess in that case, like, what do we do when we recognize those things?
Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, like, when we recognize within ourselves that there are flaws, and see our imperfections, and we see that, you know, rooted in our traumas, the instinct, and this is like what my whole thesis was about, our instinct is to withdraw and hide away from other people, you know. And that's, again, you know, to point back to Adam and Eve and what they did, that's exactly the pattern, you know. The writers nailed that, and that's our tendency, is to like cover up the part of ourselves that's flawed and problematic. And so ultimately, you know, the remedy is actually the opposite of that. You know, when we see our traumas and our flaws, it's to expose those and show those to other people who are willing and able to hold that space well for us, who love us and who really, you know, care for us and want to see us do well. That's, you know, how would I say this? Like, what is God's response to Adam and Eve after the fall, after they go and hide? What does he do?
Yeah, he covers them up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but even before that, what he does is he goes after them. He goes looking for them. He's calling for them. Like, where are you? Where are you? And that's like, that's how we.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And our nakedness, our vulnerability, our flaws. It's like by exposing those two.
So that would be God coming for that. So he's kind of, that was God coming and trying to reconcile in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not like he didn't.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah, you know, I like to, maybe, especially about halfway through, maybe, I like to get vulnerable. So, yeah, you know, so that's one thing that, you know, I've definitely noticed for myself, where I feel like I'm hopefully at the end of it, but I recognize I'm in a place where I don't feel the same kind of motivation to study God's word or to pray or to just love God the way I used to or the way I want to. And what's interesting about that is because I recognize, because I've let this other sin get in the way of it. And in a way, it's like, I think I have, like you said, I've allowed shame, the shame of that sin, to come in between those things. And I'm kind of afraid to go to God in this because it's like, well, I'm vulnerable and I'm ashamed in front of him right now.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And so the natural side of me is, the natural side is like to continue to turn, but it's like, oh no, really, I just need to like own up to it and lean into it. Be like, yeah, I did screw up, you know, help me heal from this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the natural tendency, like the you know, to go back to what I said a minute ago about Martin Luther, it's that desire to like to turn away, you know, and withdraw from connection and communion.
Yeah.
And instead, you know, the exact opposite is really what we need. And what's great about that, Paul, is that it's not just on us. It's God chasing after us. That's what the whole idea of the incarnation is, right? Is like God, you know, went out of his way to be, you know, to become human, to take on the you know, the physical body. And you know, that's the point of it. It's like he's not just like, you know, Paul's just what a screw up. he's not like that at all, you know? Like there's this fascinating passage in Revelation where you know, John's writing and he says, I heard about the kind of like conquering hero, basically. I heard about God who's going to come and like set everything right and, you know, wipe out all evil and like do all this. And then it says that, and the turn of phrase here is just fascinating. It says, I turned and when I saw, he didn't see a conquering king. He heard about the conquering king, but when he actually, you know, turns and looks and sees, what he sees is a lamb standing there slain. And that's the image of like, you know, blood dripping down. And it's like, what does that symbolize? And really what it symbolizes is that God is, you know, God's bleeding our blood and crying our tears. You know, he's not a stranger to our shame and our sense of alienation. No, he feels that. It's like he's a feeling God, not just, you know, not just some guy in the big guy in the sky. No, he feels our pain. And that to me, you know, that is transformative. You know, when you feel like you're flawed and not enough and you just, you know, you feel like you suck and why would anyone accept me? And it's like, well, because, I mean, God is chasing after you and because he feels that pain, you know, and it's incredible. It's incredible.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And like you said in your thesis as well, it's not, he doesn't just get it on paper. Yeah. He's not just some guy's like, yeah, I wrote it down. I can, in theory, I understand. It's like, no, he actually understands it and feels that and sympathizes with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely, we're not alone in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Right. Which is awesome. It's really cool.
So true.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that's probably, if anything, I think that's that was a big part for me. And I've been teasing at some point, I think in season two when we start, I'll probably like fully share my testimony. I've shared bits and pieces of it. But I think that's one thing that I recognize for myself and that I've recognized from others as well. It's one of the most common lies that we all believe is that we're the only ones struggling with this thing. We're the only ones dealing with this whatever particular thing it is, when really it's like, you're not. And I know for me, that was one of the most comforting things to recognize that I'm not the only person who's struggling with this. You know, Jesus himself struggled. He overcame it, but he still struggled, you know, the way that we struggle with who we are and what we're supposed to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Because what the fear is, within, you know, there's something wrong with me. And we'll just stick with, you know, with sex here. It's like, why would God give us a sex drive before marriage? Right. Like that's the great question, you know, like, he could have just dropped that on you when you got married, if that's his design. Right. And so it's like when you're growing up or whatever, you have this urge, you know, or like, yeah, like a libido and, what do you know, I can't do anything with this, you know, that's kind of the feeling. And then it's like, there's that urge or that libido is like, that means there's something wrong with me. And so, you know, then now I'm marked as flawed and I need to hide that. I need to keep it secret, you know, and lock it in the dungeon and, you know, never let it out. And, you know, pretend like it doesn't exist. And that's crazy making, you know, because you feel afraid that your flaws will make you unacceptable. And that if people really knew who I was, if people really knew, they wouldn't want anything to do with me. You know, that's what shame is.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I hear that 90 Day Fiancé all the time. I'm admitting that I've watched that show. Yeah, so I'm glad you tied it back into that too. I'm really glad that you tied it back in, because it's easy for us to kind of trail off on these very related ways of speaking about it, but then it gets disassociated in a lot of ways between, you know, the conversation of shame and the conversation of sexual shame. It seems like for a lot of people, they can be disassociated from each other. And like you said, I know people that have, you know, engaged in premarital sex or whatever other activity, and they feel shame for that, and they're afraid to bring it up because of how people are going to think about them or talk about them. And it's one of those hard things. For me, it's like, all right, how do I, and this is kind of the question I'm asking, is how do we get to a place where we can recognize that as, you know, sin is sin? It's like someone may have premarital sex, someone may just eat way too much, and recognizing that those are in a sense like the same thing. It's like it's all sin. It's all a form of, you know, the nature of man, and not condoning it, but also not, I don't like saying it this way, but it's like, how do we get to a place where we're not condemning that person for having made a mistake, but also not condoning it and saying like, well, it's okay, go and do whatever you want. I know it's kind of like a blah question.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really, you know, you have to lean on the example of Christ, right? Like, what did he do with the woman who had been caught in adultery? What's he do? He doesn't pick up stones and stone her. Neither does he say, well, yeah, you know, go kick. There's no standard. It's all relative. You know, he doesn't go either of those routes. He rides the middle with that and says, you know, listen, if you're without sin, you're the first, you should be the first one to cast a stone. And obviously, you know, he's the only one there who's capable of doing that and chooses not to chuck the rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instead, he forgives her for that and, you know, helps her through it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, you can imagine, like, being the woman.
That can be tough on.
Oh, sorry.
No, go for it. Go for it.
I was going to say, I don't know if you've ever pictured yourself in that story as the woman. But, like, imagine what that would have been like. You're about to die. Mm. Right? You're about to get, you know, like, the whole town is about to throw stones at you. And here comes this guy who's, like, who just, like, drops a truth bomb on you and saves your life and sends you on your way. That is what, you know, that is that picture right there is like, it's why I, you know, consider myself a Christian.
Yeah. Right on the precipice of death. And we see someone reaching out to us and it's like, whoa, that's crazy. Someone, you know, very undeserving people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, yeah, like that right in the middle of the worst moment of your entire life.
Yeah. that's the power of the gospel right there. It's like, dang, like in every form of it, I'm guilty. And yet he's like, well, here you go. So on the one side, I'll ask is, because it's, I think, especially now, I think when it comes to sexual shame, I think that's a fairly common issue for people. That's a very common thing people are struggling with. So what's like I'm kind of putting you on the spot with this. What would you say is like a practical thing or something that we can do to help others with that?
To help others, not ourselves.
I'm making it a little extrinsic now.
Yeah, that's fine. So what I would say is like starting to have these kinds of conversations where it's out in the open, you know, because that's where shame thrives in secrecy. You know, it's like mold, right? Like it likes being in the dark, or mushrooms maybe would be a better one, but like it likes the dark. And as long as it's hidden, it's got its claws in you. It's got you it within its grip. And there's nothing you can do to really escape that shame as long as it's hidden. And so, you know, for the truth is like bravery, vulnerability, willingness to be vulnerable ourselves with our own stories, that opens up the space for other people to be free to talk about it as well. That's the real key, is it's not something, you know, we have to be a trained counselor to do. It's something that you have to, you know, wrestle with your own shame. So that there's and speak to it, you know, that vulnerability, that self-compassion, it opens up the door for other people to be able to to share their own stories of shame.
Yeah. That's some scary stuff.
Yeah, it is.
I think, yeah, that's the scary part about it too. It's brutal. I'm sure everyone's probably had this moment where, you know, it seems like often the perfect situation never happens, but every once in a while, like, it seems to. And you're sitting there in that moment, you're like, all right, I could share this thing and potentially benefit from that. Or I could share something and someone may be able to come and help me. And then you get like that sweaty palms and you're like, oh crap, I don't know what to do. And then you just don't do anything. It's like in that moment, it's like, all right, you got to say something. Yeah, that's tough. That's really tough.
Yes, it is.
So I'll ask the next step to that is, because this is something that I've experienced, is when you do have the moment where you do share something and you get that feeling of, because I mean, I think especially with something like this is a difficult thing to swallow for people because we've all been trained to like not talk about it, like we said earlier. So when it does come to someone, maybe it's, you know, you share it and you get kind of a feeling of rejection from others who are unwilling to engage with that with you. It seems like that can cause like a circle of shame then. So what would you say to someone who's maybe experienced that, or maybe if you have that moment, like what do you do then?
Yeah, that's profoundly difficult. I mean, that's like your worst nightmare come true, right? Like, what if I'm vulnerable and it actually, you know, flops, and people are like, yikes.
Yeah.
Now I totally changed how I, you know, everybody's how they think about me and like, yeah, I don't want to hang out with Paul anymore, you know? So what that boils down to is like being careful and selective about who you share with, right? Not everybody's capable of you know, treating you like Jesus treated the woman caught in adultery, you know, and that's like we all know that there are some people who are better at holding that space than others. You know, especially people who haven't processed their own stuff, because it's like if somebody's doing something is carrying around this shame and guilt and they share it and you reject them, it's because you don't realize that you are capable of doing exactly that thing. You're capable of, you know, being as flawed as they are. You're not comfortable with your own flaws. And that means like, well, I can't be around you because, you know, it's almost like a disgust response, right? Like where we smell something bad and you kind of like, ugh, you know, gross. And you pull away and it's really because we just don't recognize that we're capable of the same thing. So you know, you take an addiction, for instance, and like the 12-step groups, like there is no more open and accepting people, maybe a group of people, maybe anywhere in the world, you know, because they all recognize that like, I'm an addict too. And that allows that kind of acknowledgement of your own flaws means that you can see and accept other people who are flawed as well, or who are struggling with an addiction or whatever, you know? So yeah, that's what I would say is like, pay attention to who you're sharing that with and, you know, find a therapist because how long are you want to carry this big secret? You know, like, don't you want to let that go? So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know I'll speak for myself here too. I know I've heard this from others as well, where it's when you do carry something like that, whether it's as small as like a lie that you told someone, or it's something as big is like you're hiding this part that you feel shame for of yourself. When it comes to stuff like that, is you're in another way, you're creating like this other reality. You know, there's the face that you put in front of people that is hidden from all this stuff that you're ashamed of or afraid of. And then there's a part of you inside of you internally that's struggling with it, not knowing what to do with it. And yeah, it's this crazy burden, like you said. It's just very taxing on your brain to be able to sustain these two individuals on a day-to-day life. And it's not a burden that we need to carry.
Right. Yeah, that's like one of my clients described it as a carefully manicured exterior. And yeah. Eventually, like, yeah, what happens, that exterior, you know, you kind of like lose your real self and kind of become this facade. And you forget, you know, even you forget what's really you and what's this pretend version of you. And that, wow. Yeah, it's just like really heavy to carry that around.
Wow. So what would you say, since we're on this too, I don't want to lose the moment. What would you say to someone who, where should they go to find a therapist?
That's a good question. they, like, there's obviously websites like Psychology Today. Not every therapist is listed on there. But what I'd say is, like, talk to somebody who's been in therapy and get a recommendation from them for somebody who's local. I might also suggest that you talk to somebody who is a therapist. If you know somebody who's a therapist, like, talk to them and say, hey, who would you recommend? Who do you know that's really good? And obviously, like, you know, pastors can step into some of that role.
That's
too.
Good.
You know, usually they have referrals for people who are, well, for counselors, you know, local counselors that they trust, or they should anyway.
That's really good. That's good to know. Cause I know if someone's like me, I have no idea. Even I'd just Google it and probably come up with some bad resources. Be like WebMD, they have it's a therapist now.
Well, yeah, you're even you know, stuff like BetterHelp where you can text a therapist. You know, like, it can be really scary to think about, like, man, if you're really carrying a big burden and a big secret, like, it can feel terrifying to be like, oh gosh, you know, I'm gonna have to share all this stuff. And it's like, if you haven't been in therapy before,
that's what I've been avoiding.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'll even say for me, it's like I've definitely worked through a lot of stuff, but that was more, you know, on my own with God or in small conversations with people I trust. And I would say for myself, I'd be terrified to go into a therapist. It's like, yeah, that's a scary moment, but recognizing that there's potential for healing on the other side should be well worth it.
Right. And that's why I said that there is, like, the solution to shame is, bravery, you know, because you have to show who you really are, you know, and you have to take that risk. And step out and be vulnerable, because that's, otherwise it's gonna keep you trapped.
And it's so amazing that throughout scripture we see that exact message of, you know, vulnerability can be a good thing. And yeah, we should strive to, I mean, that's the thing that I it's kind of a Christianese term at this point, but the idea of like, oh, we're broken people. It's like, yeah, let's not forget what that means. Like, for ourselves, like, you might be healed from something, but recognize that, I mean, you're still broken, but also, like, you were a broken person too. And we need to have grace for others who aren't where we're at.
Yeah, how I would say that is, God is not surprised by our nakedness. Right? He's not caught off guard by it. He knows all about it. So why
keep... That's good. I like that. Wow. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That's really good. That's why you're the doctor. Wow.
Yeah,
that's some really good stuff in there. I've definitely really appreciated reading that. And if you're okay with it, I'd love to be able to, you know, leave a link up somewhere for people to be able to read it as well, if you're okay with that. Your thesis, yeah. Sorry.
Probably. I look at it now and I'm like, oh man, there are like spelling errors that I'm finding that I thought I proofread before. How did this get even, you know, what I should do, actually, what I think I would prefer to do, Paul, is like, what if I do a summary paper of it? Because it's 85 pages long.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I don't know how many people are going to read all of that, but if I were to summarize it, I could do that. That would be pretty easy to do.
That would be amazing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that'd be great. You know, there's a lot that I learned from it too. Even talking as well, hearing the more one-on-one, answering some of the questions I had even throughout it. It was great.
Good.
Yeah. And yeah. I appreciate your heart for wanting to tackle a topic that is such a taboo.
Yeah.
Because it really is. But I think, yeah, it's we want to love others well. And I think part of caring for other people is, is, you know, where they're at. And that's where a lot of people are at. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, like you said, the more we talk about it and... Yeah, just being open with that, even through the uncomfortable part. I know if you sit in a group of people and they want to talk about God, then you start talking about pornography, they're gonna be like, okay.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to struggle through that uncomfortability.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's critical. I mean, I've worked with a lot of people who have out of control sexual behaviors, and. Certainly never seen any of them, like anybody get out of it by themselves. You know, you need your community. You need people who are there to support you and challenge you and, you know, and care for you and really help you wrestle with like, what role does porn actually play for me? You know, like what is it actually doing? What needs is it attempting, you know, what needs am I using porn to meet? Because it's always it's always something really deep. It's not just like, oh, you know, I can't stop doing that. It's like built on top of this layers and layers of relational or other kinds of trauma.
Yeah. The way I like to say that too. Is, you know, it's a symptom of a problem. It's not the problem.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. Or even, you know, the same way we look at alcohol, it's a form of medication too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The question is why?
Yeah. What are you medicating?
Bingo. The other thing I want to talk about a little bit, just as kind of like a, because I wanted to make sure that we don't miss this, is like the connection between trauma and shame. In my clinical practice, one of the main areas I focus on is working with like people who've been sexually abused. There's like almost universally an experience of like, there's something wrong with me, or I'm flawed, dirty, broken, ugly. Like this deep and abiding sense of shame of like, that's not something I can bring up and talk about in public. That's a part of me that I have to keep locked up and, you know, in the basement.
Wow.
Because, you know, nobody's there to hear. And I think, for us as, you know, people of the church, like there's no more important thing that we can do than allow those people to have a voice and to share and to talk about what happened. Because, you know, again, God's not caught off guard by that. You know, like I said, he's crying our tears, you know, and bleeding our blood. Like, that's a pretty high level of empathy. I've been a therapist for 8 or 9 years, I guess, 8 years. And I've cried with a lot of my clients, like a lot of them, but I haven't gotten to the point of bleeding yet, fortunately. So,
yeah.
But that's the deal, right? Is like, if we as a community choose to cry, with survivors of abuse and trauma, then, you know, we're not just reflecting God, we're embodying him.
Yeah. That's empathy for others that we need to feel. So how does that relate then when it comes to, you mentioned earlier, even with attachment theory, how do those things play together?
Yeah. So yeah, I can speak to that for sure. So, fundamentally, you know, like you think about somebody who's supposed to protect you and care for you, and with something like sexual abuse, like it's absolutely ruptures that, you know, it destroys that, you know, intimate caring connection that you're supposed to have with that person. You know, it just grenades it. And so, you know, you end up being suspicious. Can I really trust anyone, you know, especially people in authority, especially people who are supposed to protect me? Can I trust anyone? And, you know, like a normal, healthy development, with attachment theory, the answer to that should be immediately yes. You know, like in healthy attachment, what should happen? Like if a kid falls down and skin their knees, right? Like the first thing that a little kid, the first thing they do is they turn and look at their parents or the adults, right? To see how they should respond, see how they should react. In unhealthy attachments, they don't look at the adult. They you know, realize that the adult is going to make it worse by yelling at them or whatever, you know, whatever. They'll withdraw into themselves and isolate some more. So they're directly tied up together. But there's another experiment called the Stanley Tronick. If you haven't seen that experiment, you should definitely go YouTube it. There's like a 5-minute video clip where he kind of explains what attachment is and how it works. But what's fascinating is they have this baby in a seat, right? And the mom is right here playing, and kind of interacting, you know, and they're having fun and, you know, just kind of playing around with each other. And then they have the mom look away and then look back, and her face is just stone, right? Like she's not reactive. And what happens for this kid is they lose the ability to regulate, because they depend on the adult to help them regulate their emotions. And so, you know, the little kid will scream and try and, you know, hey, pay attention to me, you know, like start responding to me.
Wow.
And then eventually it gets so overwhelming because they're not getting the appropriate feedback from the mom that they start screaming. And then eventually they just kind of shut down, you know, they'll look away from the face because
no way.
Dysregulating. Yeah. It's super fascinating. And so,
wow.
So when we talk about, shame, trauma, and attachment, what we're really saying is like, what we need is someone to turn their face back to us. You know, the Old Testament talks a lot about God turning his face away from the Israelites, right? And that what that's doing is indicating relational distance. I'm not invested. I'm not connected. I'm not, you know, I'm not giving you eye contact. And that's, it's like this, it's an incredible picture because it's like, you know, you think like God turning his face away. I don't know what that means, but you know what it means, but you don't really know what it means. And it's about that dyadic attachment between God and Israel, or, and the, you know, essentially the parent and the child. And so to heal shame, and especially sexual shame, what we need is that reattunement, reattachment. And so, where the mom, you know, looks back at the baby and then starts responding normally, to the interactions. And that's what allows a dysregulated infant to recover their, whatever you want to call it, equilibrium, emotional equilibrium. And it's exactly the same thing with shame, is when you're in shame, you want to hide, you want to, you know, like disappear into a pit or withdraw or whatever. And so, it's very hard to make eye contact with somebody when you're ashamed in the moment. But that's what you actually need, is because you're expecting to see in their eyes disgust, disappointment, anger, maybe whatever. Instead, what you get is like this, oh man, I'm heartbroken for you, you know? Like if it's something that's really deep, what that begins to do is, as you consistently get that kind of interaction, a positive kind of interaction, what that begins to do is heal those attachment wounds and creates a secure bond where I can trust you. I know I can trust you. I know I can go to you with anything, and I'm not going to get rejected. I'm not going to get told that I'm gross or whatever. Instead you like you respond to me with empathy and attunement. That's how attachment and shame and trauma all kind of, you know, they all blend together.
Wow. So one of the interesting things I heard from that as well, I'm talking about myself again here, but this is what it reminded me of is, especially when we're looking at the child, is like, there's a lot where we have to relearn, in a sense. I know there's a point for me where I had to actually like learn how to emote properly, where, you know, I was telling someone a story, and at the end of it, they're like, do you know, that's actually really traumatic. And for me, I was like, I have no idea. What are you talking about? And they had to teach me like why what I was saying was actually trauma and why it wasn't good. And it was a strange place to be, where it's like, I actually had to rely on someone else to help teach me like how to view circumstances properly and how to properly react. And I, like you said, there was that reattachment that kind of happened, that reliance on, you know, like the mother child situation, where I'm like, okay, help me then, because I don't know what to do with this. So it seems like there's a huge level of, like you said, relearning. Oh, go for it.
Yes. Yeah. All I was going to say is like, absolutely. Absolutely. Because if you were traumatized earlier in your childhood, you know, be that sexual, physical, verbal, whatever, you're learning that I cannot trust. Fundamentally, the world is not a safe place. You know, that's one of the markers of PTSD, is like the world isn't a safe place anymore. Like my expectations are of how the world should be just, you know, crumbled, or even like worse if it's, you know, early childhood. Like I didn't even get a chance to build that. My basic assumptions, building blocks that I'm using to understand the world are that the world is dangerous. I can't trust people, and particularly people in authority, right? Like my parents, e.g. my parents. Wow. You know? And that's why that's such a problem, is, you know, we're herd animals, right? Like we have, we have in the limbic system. So if this is your brain, right, this is the gray wrinkly part, that's the cortex. Inside is the limbic system in the middle. And then this is your brain stem, right? In the limbic system, there's a part of our brain that is, they're referred to as mirror neurons, and that's what makes us a herd animal. So it's like the same reason if I, if I yawn or talk about yawning or, you know, whatever, eventually, yeah, I'm going to get you. Yeah, right? And that's because
I'm feeling it.
Yeah, it's because the mirror neurons within our brain are attempting to tune us to other people, whether that's their emotional states or their, you know, like when geese fly, you know, if one goose flies, they all go. It's like, it's exactly that kind of response, because it's like, the world is too big and too complex for me to understand all of it. And so I have to lean on other people to help me regulate my emotions and mood, and also like to indicate danger, that kind of stuff. So,
wow.
That's, you know, and when you fundamentally cannot trust another person because of, you know, early trauma, it's like you lose that ability to, you know, to be a part of the herd almost, you know, you lose your community because, and again, you know, speaks directly to what I said earlier about how, as you know, as the church, we need to start talking about this, you know. It's so important. It's so important because you're singled out. You're not a part of the herd anymore because you've got this trauma, unspeakable trauma that there's no space for. Yeah.
That's huge. Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's huge. And that's, yeah, it's, man, there's a lot in there. There's a lot. And I think that's where I see, you know, that's where we see the hurt of, I'll say the church, we could say the world, we could say everybody, because it really is everybody. But I guess to be specific, what we see, you know, with the church, it's like, yeah, it's full of a lot of hurt people with a lot of trauma, and we should be the first ones to reach out to others and listen to them and empathize with them because we're in the same boat. And we see the mess that gets created when we lose that ability to relate with other people. We lose that ability to join the herd, like you said. And when we do that, it's like, wow, that's such an attack, and it causes so many problems. And we see, I think in a lot of ways we could even argue that that's why we see so much division inside of, you know, I'll say the church, we could say anything. We see so much division because of the trauma people don't know what to do with. So we try to, in a sense, it sounds like we try to create a herd, certain people do. And because, yeah, we want to be a part of something. And when we don't know how, we're going to find the next closest thing, I guess.
Yeah, even if it's not solidly formed or like, you know, formed around something beneficial. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
Strong instinct.
Wow.
One of the things I was going to say too is like, so think about this for a minute. If you've been sexually traumatized, right, and say it's by your stepdad or something like that, you know, that's the most, probably one of the most common. That's a father figure, right? And that's essentially a stand-in for who God is. Mm. And so when you have that concept, you know, stamped from an early experience like that of like, fathers can't be trusted. What does that do to your relationship with God?
Hmm.
How can you trust God, the Father?
Hmm.
You know? How can you have victory in Jesus? You know, that old song, like, how can you have victory in Jesus when Jesus didn't save you from what happened to you?
Wow.
You know, it's profoundly difficult. Hmm. And again, and that's why it's so important to hammer what I did earlier, and we won't have to relitigate that, but like that God experiences, you know, our pain right alongside us. That's why that's so important.
Wow. Man, that's huge.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, there's a lot in there, and I know there's way more we can talk about for sure. And I say this to, I think about all of our guests, because I like to bring on interesting people. And I don't know if we've done it yet because we have so many people. This has been a long time coming to have you on as well. We've been trying to work it out with our schedules, and I'm glad that we finally did because this was fantastic. And all that to say, I really want to have you on again to talk more about this. And I'd love Trey to be here as well. I'd love to hear his insight. As well, but he's been busy with school. He's a schoolboy now. But yeah, is there anything that you would like to close with before we wrap up?
Well, I'm really grateful for having me on. It's fun to talk about. I don't get to talk about theology all that often sometimes, but you know, or at least in depth and in going into explaining some of this stuff and you know, how God, how do I say this? Like, how the God and Bible really work at healing shame as well as guilt, because you know there's all kinds of metaphors for what God does as far as our redeeming us, and those are all really important. But the one that gets hammered a lot is the sin is a debt, right? And that speaks to guilt. Like, a debt is like, you take out a debt from the bank, and if you pay it back, they quit calling you, right? Whereas shame is like the bank that never quits calling. And so it's, I think it's so important for us to have conversations like this. And it's been really fun, Paul. It's great. Yeah. It's great to chat about it. And I'm grateful. Yeah, thanks for having me on. And I'd love to come back on.
Yeah. Thank you again. I'm really looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say about this as well. We want to hear from you. We want to hear, you know, your journey, if you have one, or if you want to start that, you know, we want to be here to help listen, help point you in the right direction. I know some of the resources that Johnny gave, we're going to be putting those in the description as best we can. And we want to help people be healed and overcome the best that we can. And thank you so much to Maximize Digital Media and Annie Yuli for producing this episode. And we will catch you guys on the next one.